This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union, with 125,000 members and nearly 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. DC 37 members, there are now more ways to stay in touch with the union. You can check out the website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. That's State of the Union, one word, at dc37.net. City Hall must enact a new city budget by July 1st. That means there are budget negotiations going on between the mayor and the city council. Tonight, we're going to discuss DC 37's priorities for the new budget with DC 37's political action director, Jeremy John, who's joining us by phone. Good evening, sir. How are you?
Good evening, Chris. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, but you're busy. You're trying to influence the outcome of the New York City budget. What are our priorities as we talk to lawmakers about the 2020 city budget?
So this year's budget is different than previous budgets, where the state, because of the things that are happening in Washington, the state has suffered a loss in revenue, and it has trickled down to the city. So we, as DC 37, we've bifurcated our asks. We have the asks where we are trying to maintain city services, like with our parks, with our libraries, so on and so forth. But we also have a host of ideas in which the city can generate revenue by expanding the city workforce. So we have the two bifurcated asks that we're working with members of the city council and the administration to try to achieve, all, again, to protect public services.
We had Maria Policarpo on a couple of weeks ago, and she was talking about the need to, we're leaving revenue. The city is leaving revenue on the table by not investing enough in the workforce on the issue of tax assessments and the like. That's clearly one of our priorities, correct?
That is one of our priorities. We don't have the adequate amount of workforce in which we can go after property taxes, in which we can go after properties that do not file the appropriate property tax forms. So the city is leaving hundreds of millions of dollars on the table. And we're lobbying right now, both the city council and the administration, to invest in new tax assessors, both for the Department of Finance and for the Tax Commission, so that we can actually achieve and bridge some of the financial gap that the city has endured over the last year.
And you mentioned parks and libraries. It's kind of amazing to me. These are, parks and libraries are the jewels of the city. What is it that we need to be doing as we've been fighting on their behalf?
So the unfortunate thing that exists right now is that we have over 100 parks workers, CPWs, gardeners, that are on a year-to-year schedule, right? So every July they have to worry about whether or not they'll have a job for the coming year. And, the city council has done and the administration has done yeoman's work to try to sustain those jobs, but we have to fight for them every year. And we are partnering with Legal Conservation Voters and members of the city council to form the Play Fair Coalition that is advocating to maintain those parks jobs, to make sure that the parks, like you said, the jewel of New York City, remain beautiful and accessible to all New Yorkers.
In technical terms, that's what's known as baselining those jobs, right? Making sure that they are in the budget every year so that we don't have to go back to the city hall every year to fight for them, correct?
Correct. That is our goal, is to make sure that the money for those workers are baselined within the budget, so so that those folks will have a peace of mind that they know that they will have work. They will have a job for them and their families.
We're talking with Jeremy John. Jeremy is the director of DC 37's Political Action Department. And, you know, this all speaks to everyone saying, well, I will get an email from someone saying, why you guys focus so much on politics? And that the reason you started to mention this at the beginning of the show, where you said that due to what's happening in Washington, that has come down to affect the city of New York. Could you be a little bit more specific there?
I mean, the biggest thing for us is the Trump's tax policy, where he cut taxes for the rich, but put a larger burden on middle-class Americans. And we've seen where the tax collection and the revenue has completely diminished, where you have folks in the 1% and even the 2% are paying significantly less taxes. And, you know, the burden is falling on hardworking middle-class folks who are spending more on tax dollars. And with that, increase in their tax output, there's still a larger deficit that we're seeing as a country, as a city, and as a state. And that's the burden. That is a quagmire. That is Washington, D.C. Right?
Well, it's amazing how I remember when I was in Washington, D.C. a few years ago when the president was named Obama and the Republicans were going crazy over deficits. This was on the heels of an economic crisis, the likes of which we hadn't seen since the Depression. And yet they were saying that we could not do deficit spending. And here they've blown that totally out of the water with this tax cut.
When you're in power, your perspective changes.
I'd say so, brother. I'd say so.
the goal of the Republican Party historically has been to reduce the taxes on the rich, and it's one of the things that we've advocated for, that there be a fair share, that everyone pays their fair share, that the goods and services that is provided by the city, state, and all localities, that the burden is spread across and not on the backs of middle class and working families.
We have fought before and we continue to fight on the public safety area regarding civilianization. This is one of those things that seems crystal clear on the merits, but always seems to be a difficult fight nevertheless.
And it's an important fight, right? The thing that needs to be noted about civilianization in particular is that there are able-bodied workers, particularly in law enforcement and the fire department, able-bodied workers who should be out in the streets, who should be providing fire safety, but they're right now taking up the jobs of our members, our clericals in particular. And at the last count, Chris, there's been somewhere between 200 and 300 clerical positions that are filled by folks who need to be out in the streets protecting our city, protecting our citizens. And it baffles me that this continues to be an ongoing problem. I know 1549 and the leadership of President Eddie Rodriguez has been waving this flag for years. And we're seeing slow progress, but we're not seeing progress at the pace in which we need to see it.
Jeremy John is the director of the DC 37 Political Action Department. Hey, listen, I want to thank you for taking the time. Get back to City Hall and go do your thing, bro.
I'm on my way, brother.
Thank you. Up next, we're taking a trip back to Trump Twilight Zone with Charles Learson, who is the ghostwriter of Surviving at the Top, Trump's second book after The Art of the Deal. And we're also going to get a history lesson on labor from author Brandon Weber. We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today, 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. We've been doing periodically a segment called Trump Twilight Zone. And now joining us by phone is author Charles Learson, who is the writer of Trump's second book, Surviving at the Top. Welcome to State of the Union, Mr. Learson.
Hey, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
You wrote this book with Trump some 25 years ago?
Yeah, it's a long time ago. It's about that much now, yeah.
How did you come to be his co-author?
Well, I was coming off a book. I was working at Newsweek at the time. That was my main gig, as a writer at Newsweek back in the days when Newsweek was a big deal. And I had my hands full, but I had three kids to put through college. So I was looking for other work, and I picked up the job as a ghostwriter on a book with Chuck Yeager, the guy who broke the sound barrier.
Oh, yeah, the Right Stuff guy.
Right, yeah. And this was the, with Yeager, it was a sequel to his, he had a big bestseller. And when that happens in the book world, the sort of the market demands that they do a follow-up, and even if there's nothing more to say. And so that was certainly the case with Yeager, that there was nothing more to say. But I did this book with him, and it did well, and somehow he squeezed the orange, got some more juice out of it. And Yeager was also kind of a difficult character. He's still around in his 90s now, but he's a difficult character to deal with. So I developed a reputation in the publishing business as someone who could deal with difficult characters. It wasn't entirely earned, but it was my reputation. But who could deal with difficult characters and also do a sequel? And because the book I was doing with Trump was the sequel to The Art of the Deal, which had been is a legendary book. Yeah, and the book that kind of made him, even before The Apprentice, in the sense that it created this fictional character named Donald Trump, and that many people mistake for the real guy. So that's how I got. They set me up to talk to Trump. I was supposed to just have a preliminary conversation to see if we could get on well, and we wound up talking and shaking hands on a deal. And he was pretty easy to deal with. You know, you have to remember he was not a horrible human being. Well, he was, but it was a secret at the time. I mean, he was becoming one. The seeds were just sprouting. He would later, not long after this, take the Central Park Five ad out in the New York Times and all. But he wasn't like that around me. We never talked about that kind of stuff. And he was a goofy. I'm from the Bronx, and he's from Queens. I kind of saw him as a fellow goofy bridge and tunnel guy until I got to know him a little better and saw he was way beyond goofy.
Well, he also, as you say, this was the second book. That book made him in many ways. And as you were working with him, facts come out now that show that he was in big, big financial trouble at the time that you were writing a book called Surviving at the Top.
That's right. Yeah. Well, the book I did with him was structured, and Tony Schwartz wrote The Art of the Deal, did a beautiful job, unfortunately, of creating this fictional character, which he now regrets, I know. And then I came along, and the book we did was going to be about, so what's it going to be about? Trump has already told his story. It's going to be about these deals he's done just fairly recently, these big deals he got. After the Art of the Deal came out, Trump was in what I call a King Midas period, where everything he touched turned into a good deal. The banks were throwing money at him. And so he bought the Plaza Hotel. He bought the Eastern Airlines shuttle and turned it into the Trump shuttle. He bought that gigantic yacht that he had that was more like an ocean liner, and he also increased his holdings in Atlantic City, until he had, I think three casino hotels down there. So he was putting out, businesses was growing by leaps and bounds, but it was a ridiculous situation because none of these things were making money, and in fact they were losing a lot of money. And I compare it to the only way I can understand it. I'm not a financial guy, but if you buy a house and you put down very little money, your mortgage payment every month is going to be scarily large. And that's what happened with Trump. The banks loaned him a tremendous amount of money. He put down maybe nothing or a dollar symbolically. And now he had this, every month that bill comes due on the Plaza Hotel and these casino hotels and the airline shuttle that he bought. And for a while, he could get away with it because Atlantic City was pumping out so much money, the casinos. But then they went south for just a little while, and his whole empire cratered, and he couldn't make that monthly mortgage bill, and suddenly everything was in chaos. And as a writer, I didn't know that until we were at the end of the process, and I think it was Forbes magazine did the first story that said, actually, he has a net worth of less than zero, and then all kinds of other things happened in his life. His wife left him. Mike Tyson got knocked out. Tyson was his meal ticket down in Atlantic City to get people into his hotels. So I was there during that sweet King Midas period, and also during the crash. And we try to salvage the book by hurriedly rewriting the end of each chapter was about the Plaza. And then I got tired of running the Plaza Hotel and sold it at a huge loss. Made up some nonsense, And a lot of people called us on it, too. But the book still was a pretty big seller.
I'm listening to you describe what basically sounds to me like the not-so-great Gatsby. is that a fair analogy? I mean, as we know now, there is a lot of money. Trump likes to talk about how he built it single-handedly, but clearly there was a lot of money that he had to work with at the beginning.
Right.
And then as you say, he was able to, this Midas touch that he had, it quickly goes south. Well, not quickly, but it does go south. And yet he is able to continue to live a life that is, by all accounts, American, is a very successful one.
Well, yeah, but the other part of the other thing I learned about, to keep up with my mortgage analogy, if you're a regular Joe and you buy a house and you can't pay the mortgage, the bank will foreclose and take your house back. But if you're Trump and they've loaned you hundreds of millions of dollars, they don't do that. They don't want the Trump casino in Atlantic City. So they will work with you to prop you up and to keep you going as long as possible, to the bankers will, to save their own jobs, because now they've been exposed as making foolish loans. So that's the difference. And they kept him propped up. And also Trump knew he had to keep the BS going about his incredible lifestyle and his incredible wealth. When he confided to me once, he said, told me a story anyway of seeing a homeless man on the street and realizing that guy was better off than him because that guy had nothing and he had like minus $380 million or something.
Did he ever discuss what, when you were talking about the views that he now seems to dearly hold? Did he ever talk about the how he felt about immigration and how he felt about these other issues that have obviously polarized the nation?
No, I it was either because those thoughts hadn't coalesced yet in his mind, and he was vaguely a Democrat, registered Democrat, and he was sort of vaguely New York liberal. I don't know. He was, Trump has to fake it to be a normal human being. You have to remember that. And I say this as someone who got along well with him and parted company with him on good terms. But he's turned into a monster since then. And so I can't speak well of him because of that. But he didn't have many political opinions. He didn't have, certainly for the book, he knew that was a place we didn't want to go, and he wanted to, our job was to keep up the false image of the the rich guy, the Mr. Burns of The Simpsons, when he was really more like Homer,
Right. Was and what about attitudes towards working folks and working people? I mean, he must have employed, there must have been people in his employ, and he must have had some thoughts about how to deal with a workforce.
Well, the people around him, were lived in fear of him. The people up in the office, because he had that blustery kind of attitude, and he didn't have to answer to anyone, even though he was scared to fire anyone, and if he ever had to do that, I think he would have delegated that responsibility. You know, we know his record now dealing with contractors, not caring, not thinking about people. I mean, one of the great ironies that gets lost, one of the many things that gets lost in the whole Trump barrage of chaos, is that the people that are his supporters were people he wouldn't deign to speak to, under normal circumstances. And the people you could say he had no respect for them. He never gave them a thought. They didn't exist in his mind. They were just something. When he needed people to build something, he hired some people and then didn't pay them or negotiated a different price at the end of the process. He just doesn't have that in him. He doesn't have a caring gene he's the weirdest dude you ever met. He's not like anyone else. And sometimes that looks like coldness and hard-heartedness, and it is, but it's really just an ignorance about how to be a human being.
Charles Learson wrote the book Surviving at the Top. That was Donald Trump's second book. Listen, I knew this was going to fly by. I'm sorry that you're out in the park and it looks like rain, but I hope you enjoy the rest of the day, my friend.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been fun.
Thank you. Joining us now is author Brandon Weber, the author of Class War USA, Dispatches from Workers' Struggles in American History. Brandon was on the show a few weeks ago, and we said we need to talk more about history of labor movement and about the struggles that American people have had. Welcome back to the show, Brandon Weber.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
I want to do this. We really should do this on a regular basis because there really isn't enough. Well, we should take every opportunity we can to talk about where we came from and what is the history of this country.
Yes.
And so much of that history is not told. Let's talk a little bit about what we're trying to do here.
Working people's history and the history of other marginalized peoples, it's frequently hidden from us. It wasn't until Howard Zinn was one of the first ones who really uncovered a bunch of this history and laid it out there for people to look at and go, oh, my God, this stuff happened. This happened in our history. He did that in the People's History of the United States, which is an amazing book. So anyway, we don't talk about that stuff. We don't hear the history of working people or marginalized people. And I think we need to do more of that. We need to learn these histories.
Well, this is we're going into June. We started off the month of May with May Day. Let's talk about something that perhaps isn't as well known as May Day.
And sure.
Give us an example.
Black Wall Street was a district, Greenwood District, by Tulsa, Oklahoma. And even to this day, people that live there don't know this history because it's been hidden. So what happened was in 1921, it was a thriving African-American community with their own money. They had hospitals, churches, grocers, theaters. They had all of it. And they basically spent their own money in their own neighborhood. There was about 10,000 people that lived there, all African-American. And so the wealth stayed within the community, and it built. These people were becoming actually quite successful at what they did and running businesses and such.
This was a part of Tulsa?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, the Greenwood District. Yep.
Okay.
And so it built resentment among white folks in the community. Let's put it that way. It was also a time in our history when, it was just Jim Crow laws were being enacted. It was just on the heels of the Civil War and the Reconstruction. And so anyway, this was an area that was growing rapidly. And so let's just say the white folks there were not happy about that. And like happened many times in the teens and the 20s, 1920 all the way through 1930, they were they would accuse African-American men of attacking white women, is what it was. And then it would be a lynching, and then it would be a public lynching, and that was supposed to be an example to people, right? So
this is To Kill a Mockingbird. I mean, this is...
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, same kind of stuff. So what happened there was on the 30th of May, 1921, so 98 years ago today, a young man, Dick Rowland, he came off the elevator. There was a young white girl who was on the elevator as well, and she apparently screamed for some reason. And what happened was then he was accused of attacking her, basically. And she actually denied that to the police. She denied he did anything to her. But it built and built and built until they, when they put him temporarily in the jailhouse on the upper floor, a gang of white folks came with their guns and wanted to lynch him. So the sheriff knew that. He said, no, I'm not going to allow that to happen here. And then that built. So African-American veterans who came back from World War One came back with their rifles and with bullets. And so for the first time, they could defend themselves. And so they went to town to downtown to defend this guy, this young man. And then that built into a crowd of, you know, hundreds and then thousands of white folks with their guns. And so eventually it turned into there were 300 African-American people killed, men,
really?
And children killed. Yes. And they burned down the entire Greenwood district, all the homes, all the theaters, all the churches, all the hospitals that were built there. They burned them to the ground and chased all these people away from Tulsa area.
So the story of Greenwood is not well known, and its destruction is not. It both its wealth and its destruction have not been told.
That's right.
And what happened post destruction of Greenwood?
So the African American community was chased out of the area. They were basically told to get out of here, go west, and then the history was kind of more or less hidden for a decade. It's still kind of hidden today. That district was never allowed to rebuild. They said, no, we're not going to allow that to happen. And, you know, so it just left a mark there. But again, this is not taught. This isn't taught even in schools anywhere in the country, let alone in Tulsa itself.
And this is one of the stories you came across or you found as you were preparing your book.
Yes, that's correct. It's in the book, too.
The book is called Class War USA, Dispatches from Workers' Struggles in American History. We're talking with Brandon Weber. We're going to talk with Brandon Weber on a regular basis because I really would like you to come back with so we can do short retellings of these stories that have been not told.
Love to. Thank you.
That's just about all the time we have for this evening. I want to thank our guests, DC 37 Political Action Director Jeremy John, author Charles Learson, and historian Brandon Weber. Before we go, a couple of announcements. The DC 37 Ed Fund is accepting applications for the Interview Techniques Workshop to be held Thursday, June 6th and 13th at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. For details, call the DC 37 Ed Fund at 212-815-1700. You can also learn about issues impacting your community and union by attending the DC 37 Political Action Committee's monthly meeting on Thursday, June 13th at 6 p.m. at Union Headquarters. And if you're having trouble erasing your federal student debt, you can get help by attending a workshop at Union Headquarters on Tuesday, June 18th at 5:30 p.m. You can register at www.dc37.net/student-debt. Remember, if you have any comments about today's shows or any of our shows, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.